Well, it was good to be away, and it's good to be back. And one of the things that being away, my family and I have been away for the last month. It's just sort of our custom to go away together for some time in June. And one of the things that always seems to do in my life is that I just come back with a fresh set of eyes, you know, to this community, among other things, and feel grateful in a new way for ordinary things. A really special shout out to Tim and Jane and Atticus, of course, who gets dragged into these things, who hauled a bunch of extra freight for the past month. And I know there's lots of people involved in that, so, you know, thank you all, but Tim took on the lion's share of that. Thank you. I really appreciate it. One of the things that when we travel together as a family, one of the things we enjoy doing is watching for things that we can bring back. And they don't have to be extravagant. We don't have the money for them to be extravagant. And we've found anyway that over the years that more extravagant gifts are not necessarily more meaningful gifts. And so that's sort of not the path we take. What we try to do is look for things that might really connect with whomever we imagine sharing the gift with, right? So how would this be for them, basically, which sort of feels a little obvious. But one of the things that tends to happen is that we tend to come back with several small gifts rather than a few big ones, and they're usually for whomever we found ourselves thinking about when we were absent from them, which is kind of an interesting litmus test in itself. And so I sort of have this tradition that I try to bring something back from my travels for this community, and that's really consistent in my life with what I just said. Being away matters. It's important to step away from the intensity of people work, even if you love it, and I do, and that's all great. And when I'm away from this community, I miss the community collective, and I miss people in the community individually. And so people are just on my mind, you know, when I'm traveling. And so one of the things that I try to do is collect what I would call idea souvenirs, and bring them back. So this is that morning where I want to share some of the idea souvenirs that I collected while I was away. Finding idea souvenirs is sort of like other kinds of souvenir shopping, which for me at least means that you don't necessarily know what you're looking for. You're looking for something. And there's this niggle, right? There's this thing that says this is about that person, or in this case, this is about that community, but you don't necessarily know what the thing's going to be. It sort of reveals itself to you instead of the other way around. You know it when you see it. And on this trip, which was in Greece, we spent a fair bit of time at some of the great archaeological sites of the Western world. I mean, Greece is, of course, the geographic home of what we might commonly think of as the Western world, and I know there's academics that would take exception to that, but it's the common language. Basically, the heartland of the Greco-Roman culture, the culture on which European culture stands, and the culture from which North America was colonized. And so that's an interesting kind of space to be in. As an aside, I always take a couple of books along on long trips. In this case, when we're going across the Atlantic, that's a long plane ride. So I had a couple of books along. And one of the ones that I took with me this year was Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization, which some of you will recognize that title as the book that that Adrian Jacobs referenced when he spoke with us last year. It's a really interesting book, and I've been working on it ever since Adrian mentioned it. Adrian Jacobs is a First Nations person who that's known to the community and came and shared some of that perspective a while ago. So this is a fascinating book to be reading while you're also visiting the very places that are the birthplaces of many of the ideas that Robert Williams, the indigenous law professor who writes the book, it's the birthplace of a lot of the ideas that he unpacks in the book. So that's pretty interesting to kind of have this experience. And not least of all because the information that surrounds those places that we were visiting in Greece was usually offered to the visitor from the vantage point of the prevailing story of the history of the West. And Williams is writing about those same things from a completely different vantage point, from the vantage point of an indigenous scholar and law professor. So really intriguing. So I'm wandering around Greece, you know, I'm reading whatever, a guidebook or a plaque or something, and mostly those things are saying how great this ancient civilization was and how fortunate we are to have these roots as a Western culture in this greatness. And I'm also reading Savage Anxieties at the same time, which is about the ways these same places and ideas are the roots of Western prejudice and racism. Really interesting experience. Quite varied. Quite rich. Oh, by the way, I finished that book on the flight home. which is an accomplishment that I am singularly proud of. It took a long time to finish that book. It's not light reading. It's intriguing, but it's not easy. So now I just have to try to absorb it, which is probably going to take a lot longer than reading it did. Anyway, one of the things that sort of revealed itself to me as an idea souvenir on this trip was simply the thought that stories are super important. Like that as a species, we love our stories. And especially, we love the ones that help us to make sense of the world. We die for those stories. And I know that in the weeks before I left, I mentioned on a couple of occasions the idea that we tend to make stories that account for the data points of our experience. When we have an encounter with something, that could be an idea, but we might also have a life event or some occurrence, something that sticks with us, what we tend to do as humans is we go away and we think about it. And we want to know what it means. And then we wake up the next morning and we do it again. Like we go out into our life, maybe it happened well before we woke up, maybe we had some experiences in the night. But we have these experiences, these things that impact us, and we go away and we think about them and go, what does that mean? How does that fit? And then we start to accumulate these experiences, and they feel like things that we know. We use that kind of language for them. This is something I know. And we tend to use that kind of language because lots of times, these things are firsthand for us. They're things that we encounter with our own mind or our own body or that happen in our own spirit. They're our experiences. And so we say, I know this, and I want to account for what I feel like I know. So that when I talk about accounting for data, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about these experiences, these things that we're referencing when we're trying to make meaning, right? So then, and we can't seem to resist doing this as humans, so then what happens is we make a story that accounts for the data points. This is what we do when we dream as well, from many sort of the perspectives of dream science. What our brains are doing is they're taking all these things that were floating around loose at the end of the day and trying to turn them into a cohesive narrative. They're trying to make a story that accounts for the data points, which is why we have such whacked dreams sometimes, because sometimes things just don't fit together. But our brain's like, no. If you could fly and that car was alive, this story would work awesome, and then we have this whacked out dream, right? It's like, yeah, great, there's a story. That worked. So our brains just do this. We really, really, really don't like it if we don't know what something means. Like just as a species, we are, right? That makes us, I use the word crazy advisedly. That makes us crazy. On the other side of all of that, when we do come up with a story that seems to account for the data points, we want to cement it in place. That feels so good when we do that. We want to just camp out right there. And so what we do is we make things that are about the story. So we make smaller reinforcing stories, kind of subtext. We make art about it. We make culture about it. And of course, when we bring art and culture together, one of the things that we get is the thing that we call architecture. And so we make structures that actually point to and offer entry points or retellings of whatever that story is that made meaning of the whole thing for us. And as far as we can tell, we have always done this. It's pretty built in. So, when we started our trip out in Athens, I promised to only show you a very... I came back with just short of 6,000 pictures. I'm going to show you 4. Thank me later for my restraint. So, we landed in Athens, and that's where we sort of started our trip because it was the obvious point in Greece to come and go from in terms of travel. But one of the ways that as a family, when we travel, we just, like, we walk a lot. And it's kind of how we operate. We like to be in the spaces. So, the way we deal with jet lag is, this particular case, we landed in the morning, we just go. Like it makes that first day extraordinarily long, but your body starts dealing with the jet lag because it's out in the sunshine and it's active and your brain starts to reset all those rhythms. So we just like hit it.
And you sleep really well.
That first night, and then you're like, no jet lag, but then next night. Anyway, yeah, some of you traveled, you know about this. So we just like hit Athens, basically. And we were staying in a place where you walk out the door, walk around the corner, and look up over your shoulder, and what you see is the Acropolis. You see this enormous 7-acre flat-topped hill that has on it, you know, the most noteworthy sort of architectural item in the Western world, this thing, right? So that's what we did. We just got out there and kind of hit it right out of the chute. Now, this great ruin of a temple, I mean, you can see the reconstruction equipment inside of it. The other photograph that I don't have along this morning is of the other end of the Parthenon, which has scaffolding all over it. It's just completely covered in scaffolding. And there's this enormous crane built inside of it. They're sort of trying to put it back together. But this humongous monumental structure was built around a story. And it was built around a story that was meant to cement a civilization's understanding of basically how life, the universe, and everything works. Now, it must have been a pretty staggering spectacle when it was intact. I mean, it's pretty mind-blowing now, and it's in shambles. Some of those shambles are because of the ravages of time and weather, of course. I mean, the place is 2,500 years old, which is kind of an interesting experience in itself, to just walk around something that old. But most of the damage is because in 1687, which feels like near history when you're talking about 2,500 years, the Venetian army was at war with the Ottoman Turks, who had occupied Athens at that point. So the Ottomans had, control of the Parthenon, and they were using it to store their gunpowder, because you got to put the stuff somewhere. And so the Venetians hit the place with a mortar round and, blew the roof off and just smashed it all to bits. More on that in a moment. The Greek story, the story that got the place built, was about the goddess Athena, of course, right? Athens, Athena, it's right there in our face in the name. And how honoring Athena was basically, I'm selling an enormous story short here, but for the sake of time, that story was basically about how honoring Athena was the path to being a strong and victorious civilization. From the Greek vantage point, and this is a thing that Williams makes a great deal of in Savage Anxieties, from a Greek vantage point, Greek civilization wasn't just a great civilization. Greek civilization was civilization. Everything else was savage. Everything else was sub-civilized, not civilized. The Greeks were civilization. That story of Greek civilization is grounded in the story of the goddess Athena, and that goddess coming to this group of people and empowering them to be a great civilization. So this building, when it was built for the first time, was built in a decade. That's a wacky thought, that in 10 years, the Greeks put this thing up. You gotta believe what you're doing to do that. Now, that's the Greek story. The Ottoman story was not about Athena. And there's lots of stories that happened in between there, of course, including a Christian one. This place was a Christian house of worship for a time. Anyway, it depended who was in power, right? But when the Ottoman Turks were in power, this building wasn't about Athena. It wasn't about Christ. It wasn't about any particular deity. It was about gunpowder. It was about military might. That's what that building represented to them, was a place for gunpowder. To the Venetians, whose core story was about world domination through business, this place was something to get out of the way so they could have the harbor back, because Athens is an incredibly strategic Mediterranean location. So that's what their story was about. So everybody kind of has these different stories that are morphing over time around this place. And that's fascinating to me, how stories morph over time and how that impacts the world around the storytellers and the story livers. Because if you were to talk to people who were in Athens when the Venetians were trying to take the city back, and said, what's the story that helps the data points of your life cohere? What do you make of this? They probably wouldn't have talked to you about Athena. That's not how they would have accounted for the data points. They would have probably talked to you about war, about military might, about commerce, about the seesaw between the Ottomans and the Venetians that lasted for so long. Stories matter. And we should really pay attention to what story we choose to live out of. And I think in our time, in our culture, we have room to choose, which is a remarkable thing in itself. There are probably lots of reasons why it's important to pay attention to the story we choose to live out of, but this morning, I want to suggest three. I think that we should pay close attention to the story that we live out of, because the story we live out of provides us with one of our most potent definitions or understanding of ourself. What we think about who we are is central to how we view and interact with the world. That's sort of where we start all that stuff. If we think for a moment about the great questions that we tend to wrestle with as humans, when we're trying to put together the story that we live out of, the first question for a lot of us is the question, who am I? Right? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be me, this particular human? And we go on from there. We go on to other questions. We go on to questions about the nature of the world that we live in and about power and about right and wrong and so on and so forth. But we tend to start with the self. And if we have no idea how to think about ourselves, it's pretty tough to know how to think about what's all around us. It's not that hard to see how this plays out, right? If we've been told our whole lives, for instance, that we are the greatest, then and that there's something wrong with the world if we don't get what we want when we want it, guess how we're going to act. This is, by the way, this line of thinking is sort of the short version of why the self-esteem movement demonstrably failed to deliver on its promises. If the story that we live out of says you're all that, is it a big surprise when we act entitled? You know, not really, right? Or when we treat someone that gets in the way of our getting what we want primarily as an obstacle or an object rather than as a person. Like, those things are not really that surprising if the story we're living out of is I'm the center of the universe. So, this matters. The story about who we are is at the heart of every other story we choose to live out of, and so we need to pay careful attention to which one we choose. Now, that's not a new idea, of course, right? In fact, it's an ancient one. Solomon, trying to pass on some hard-won wisdom to his son, says it this way in Proverbs. He says, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Interesting to me, I remember when I first learned that the Hebrew concept of heart is roughly akin to the Western concept of the self. So if you're reading a biblical text that says something about the heart, it's not talking about the pump. It's talking about the self. So guard yourself for everything else, your idea of who you are, because everything else flows out of that. That's ancient wisdom. And this is, by the way, one of the reasons why, personally, I don't think a mythology of cursed from the beginning is especially helpful. You start your story about the self with, I'm a piece of crap. It's really hard to make good progress. It's also why I think the same mythology that has delivered to many versions of Christianity, the idea that we're cursed from the beginning, if we actually did math with poetry, which is a bad idea, but we're going to do it anyway, good, good, and very good is like 7-1 to you're busted. Interesting. Out of that story about the self, the wise ones say everything else flows. Which brings me to the second reason that we should pay close attention to what story we choose to live out of. The story we choose to live out of not only provides us with our most potent definition of ourself, but it also guides our daily decisions, even when, or perhaps especially when, we're not aware of it. So this is kind of, there's a subtlety about this, right? This is kind of an interesting thing. For instance, if we let the culture of marketing that surrounds us inform our story too deeply, we might find that we've swallowed the idea that I am what I own. And the corollary to that is that those who own more are superior to those who own less. That's a bad idea. But once again, it's not a new story. I mean, when we look around at the spectacular things that ancient cultures built, one of the themes that occurs again and again is what I would call the architecture of intimidation. To get to this location, you have to go for quite a climb. And from the city, the Acropolis is, you can see it from anywhere in Athens, pretty much. You have to be in a really big alley to not be able to see this hilltop. It's not just the high point, it's just the lodestone of the entire area. And to get to it, you have to go up a long path, which led you past any number of other intimidating structures, including a large theater and a really complex gateway temple with these huge steps. And this is one of the things that the architects of intimidation do over and over again in ancient structures, is they make either huge steps or awkwardly small steps. But either way, they make steps that you can't be comfortable on as an ordinary human being. And the message is just like getting hammered home. We are all that. We must be right. Look at how powerful we are. Look at how wealthy we are. Look what we built. And by the way, you would be an idiot to take us on. We're right. We must be right. Look at this. It's everywhere in the ancient world. And one of the messages that flows out of the architecture of intimidation is the message that because we have more wealth and power than you, we not only have the right to rule over you, but we have the right to extinguish you. if we wish to. That's the short version of the ferocious dark side of colonization. Mic's on. Let's just see how this goes. Right? We can find a way to say our beliefs are right and look at all the power we have. So imagine the Europeans arriving in North America, right? Look at all this civilization that's running in the background of our discovery of this new land. And by the way, you can tell that God is on our side because look what we have. Look what we made. Clearly, our God story is the right one. And that gives us, and this is about the divine right of kings, which I'm not going to talk about this morning, but this is what gives the European mind as colonials this idea that it's okay to extinguish other cultures. We're right. We can prove it. Look what we made. So, if you guys would come around to this understanding of how the universe works, to this story map that accounts for the data points, then you'd be civilized, and we can kind of get on with it. And if you won't, then we'll extinguish you, and we're not going to feel uncomfortable with that because God said it was okay. And we can prove God said it was okay because look at the church we built. It's everywhere in the history of civilizations. This is a different story, by the way, than the ancient wise one that comes to us in the words of Jesus, who says, among other things, consider the lilies of the field and how they grow. They don't work or weave or sew, and yet their garments are stunning. And then just in case anybody missed the point, he chooses a personal architectural illustration that anyone in the culture would have known was connected to a bunch of buildings as well. And he says, even King Solomon, the temple builder, dressed in his most regal garb, was not as lovely as these lilies. And then he goes on to teach about the good care of God for all of creation and how that points to the good care of God for all of humanity. In other words, for all that is. It's just this field leveling, no pun intended about lilies, this field leveling perspective on how you decide what story has merit and how you make that decision. And that teaching of Jesus, not incidentally, once again goes on to acknowledge the conundrum of suffering, which I love. We will right away. You can leave that up though. Yeah, absolutely. I did, and I was just good. Just so good to see you back. I was having this enormous experience of relief that it was you back at the computer. No, I'm just kidding. It's not true. I made that all up. Yeah, you're a great husband. That's on the podcast. So I'd leave that. Mike is a great husband. It's on the podcast. Jesus in that teaching, if we kind of kept reading after the lilies part and the Solomon part, goes on to talk about how the grass dies in the winter. The same story that says God can be good and in everything and that the goodness of the divine can infuse the entire world also says, and by the way, things die. Winter comes. The grass gets killed. In the story that Jesus is telling in that text, he goes on to say, and it comes back to life. There's this new thing that comes from the death and from the suffering. But there's suffering. Just like the mythology that gives us everyone is cursed, or everyone starts out with a blessing, depending how you read the story, also says everything's not okay. There's suffering. I like that that's in there. It'd be hard to take the story seriously if it wasn't. And I also think that if we start out with a story that leaves the initiative of divine goodness out of it, like if we don't start with that as part of that blanket narrative, that meta-narrative, then what we have left to work with is sort of a version of power that I think really naturally leads to violence instead of care, to oppression instead of nurturance, to manipulation instead of trust, and to fear rather than love. Like if we start with I am what I own, we're going to find ourselves pretty naturally, I think, living out of a story that leads to worry instead of rest, into the hamster wheel of more, 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 into a life of endless striving for things that we know in our head but don't know in our life are going to just turn out to be dust. So what story we start with is just hugely important. Last souvenir idea for today. If we don't pay personal attention to the story that we're living out of, we are uniquely vulnerable to being told what story we should live out of. I'm going to just read that one more time. If we don't pay personal attention to the story that we're living out of, we're uniquely vulnerable to being told what story we should live out of. There's an oblique historic connection to this. But anyway, one of the most memorable sites for me that we visited in Greece was Delphi. We say Delphi in this part of the world, but the Greeks have their own language. Greek, in fact, Delphi. Even if we're not history buffs, we probably have a little niggle in our head that says Delphi is about an oracle. It has something to do with oracles, right? I mean, even if you went and saw A Wrinkle in Time, the Oracle of Delphi, a very, I think, hilarious version of the Oracle of Delphi showed up in that film. Anyway, so it's got something to do with oracles. And in fact, that's sort of the core of the history of Delphi. As it happened the day we were there, there was a storm clearing, and the whole time we were there, it was just like this. Super floaty, spooky. It was just like, I was just burning film. I was having a ball. Because, I mean, really? The Oracle of Delphi in this weather, in those ruins? It was just like, it was crazy. We don't actually know how Delphi got started. There's a lot of conflicting legends. This is an extremely ancient site. Basically, the ancients believed that Delphi was the center of the world. And the way that they knew that is because Zeus had released two eagles, and they flew around, and this is where they met. And so there you go. It's obviously the center of the world. And they had these stones that marked the navel of the world. They just looked like a cone, about so big around, about this high. And there's a replica of one on the site. The original that they found when they excavated is in the museum just down the hill. But there's a bunch of them. Anyway, they're outies. So the navel of the world is an outie, just so you know. So now you can file that. Historically, though, the god of choice at Delphi was Apollo. And the reputation of the prophetess, the oracle was a prophetess, was a woman, was just huge. The reputation of the prophetess as important to the culture kept growing until it reached its zenith somewhere around like the 6th to 4th century BCE. And that oracle, that prophetess, was so important in the culture's life that by that point, historically, no one would ever consider making a major decision without either personally visiting the oracle or sending an emissary to check with the oracle before they did whatever they did. And even when Greece was conquered by the Macedonians, Alexander the Great, and then subsequent to that by the Romans, they kept the place open. They kept the oracle going, and they consulted the oracle. That's a super fascinating historical story. I wish we could stop and explore it some more. But clearly, this idea that the oracle had a connection to the divine and could reveal the insight of the divine to humans was super established. And this was its location. Everybody showed up for that. Next picture, Ariel, if you want. This intriguing. This is the treasury, and I didn't because I was exercising self restraint. I didn't bring it, but just down the hill here is where the location of the center of the universe is, where the navel of the world resides. But basically, in the belief system of the day, for over 1,000 years, the god Apollo spoke to mortals through the oracle at Delphi. But, and this is where it gets super interesting to me, not directly through the oracle. The way that it worked is if you wanted to consult the oracle, you brought a gift, so money, a treasure of some sort. The building we're looking at is the treasury. And you paid up front, not after you got your oracle. And then you could consult with the oracle about anything from should we risk the future of the nation going to war to she loves me not, like, moral, religious, political. The oracle kind of had the full sweep. And what would then happen is that the oracle would reportedly breathe fumes. There's kind of hallucinogenic fumes that are released from some places, cracks in the mountain that this thing is built on. They would foam at the mouth. They would utter some gibberish to the pilgrim, and then that would be interpreted by the priests who would tell the pilgrims what the oracle said. Ray's laughing out loud. Can you see the obvious vulnerability in this system? Who holds the power, and how do they make a living? The power resides in the hands of the priests, of those that interpret what God has to say to the humans through the oracle. Does any of this sound familiar to anyone in this room? Who's telling the seekers after truth what they should live out of? What story accounted for their data? Right, not the oracle, the priests. Now, every once in a while, someone with a lot of power kind of short-circuited the system. There's this well-known story of Alexander the Great. So remember, at this point of the story, Alexander, who's the leader of the Macedonian Empire, has already conquered Greece, kept Delphi Open. So he's the military guy in charge at this point, shows up to consult with the oracle, asks the oracle, will I be successful in conquering the world? And when the oracle hesitates, he grabs her by the hair and pulls her head back and holds it there until she yells, you're unstoppable, at which point he says, I have my answer. Okay, if you need a better sort of apocryphal, whatever nature of the story is, if you need a better story to illustrate the vulnerabilities of the system, I can't deliver it. Like, I think that's just sort of right there. And this all continues until a Christian empire, the same one who shut down the original Olympic Games, closes the place in 394 CE. One last interesting connection. If you grew up around some of the more charismatic versions of contemporary Christianity, you might be familiar with a biblical text in 1 Corinthians 14 where Paul gives instructions about how to handle it if somebody in the Christian community offers a prophecy. He's dealing with the question of people speaking in unknown tongues. And basically the gist of that text and those instructions are that several people within the community need to interpret what the prophet or prophetess is saying, or the person should keep it to themselves because it doesn't benefit the community. Now, in cultural historical terms, that text to the people of Corinth, and if you just kind of look over your shoulder from Delphi, you can see the Gulf of Corinth. Those people who are sorting out how to handle the thing that Paul is writing about are the same people in the same country at the same time that the oracle at Delphi is coming off such a run of success that there were now three oracles working in shifts and priests working in shifts as well. So the oracle could operate around the clock. I find it deeply intriguing that in the history of the Christian religious tradition, a leader as influential as Paul would take what is the well-established tradition of the Delphic Oracle and give instructions that as much as say, no, we need to do this differently. Because that other system is vulnerable. The idea that there's a thin red line that comes through one person from the divine that could direct a community, that idea is vulnerable. And so what we should do instead is, if we want to hear from God so that we can sort out the story we're living out of, the better way to do that is in person, in community. I think that wisdom translates well to our culture, in which there are all sorts of prognosticators of what's to come. We don't have to travel to Delphi. Just open your browser, right? What's the future look like? What story should we live out of to live well in it? It's everywhere. There's all sorts of opportunity to wonder who's being best served by a particular version of what the right thing is to do. And more than some of it sounds like gibberish. I just think there's lots of parallels. And I think one of the lessons that coalesces for me out of that little collection of idea souvenirs from this particular trip is that our job then and now is to pay attention to the story we choose to live out of, and to remember that even though that choosing is personal work, it's ours to do, it's actually best done in community. It's actually best done drawing on the wisdom of others. Not so that the community tells us what story to live out of, but so that we have a chance to test the way we're accounting for the world around us with the experiences and perspectives of others. It assails that vulnerability that goes with the belief or the story that there is some kind of a way in which we can hear exclusively from the divine that actually supplants, takes over, supersedes all others. If you want to know the downside of that, just remember the story of colonizing Europe. That's that story. If we've got it all sewed up, our story actually accounts for all the data points, we can wipe out your story. We can just run roughshod over it personally, collectively, culturally, business-wise, whatever. It doesn't matter. Why? Because God said we could. That's the vulnerability. So we need to pay attention. We need to pay attention to the story we choose to live out of. We need to pay attention to the process by which we make those choices. We need to pay attention to the fact that if history teaches us anything, it teaches us that the story is going to change. that we're not going to hit one story that accounts for all the data points and go, there, that's done. Now all I have to do is spread it to everybody else and get them to play ball. I had to go to Greece to figure that out. You guys, what are you going to do with all the money you saved? Anyway, it was fun collecting those souvenirs, and it's fun to bring them back, and it's delightful to be in a community where they can spawn a conversation in which, among other things, people can profoundly disagree and still show up together. I love that. All right, peace.